All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Hello there, listeners. Welcome again to another episode of All the Rage. Thank you very much for listening. It's always lovely to have you with us. And this week, yet again, it's a great pleasure for me to be able to speak to someone else, a previous guest on the show. We are speaking with the writer Dee Hunter. Hello, mate. How are you doing?
I'm all right, buddy. Not too bad. Cheers. How are you?
I'm getting by. Tough times, strange times, but
indeed,
we do what we can. So the last time we had you on the show, you were doing a kind of a book tour with your first book, Chav Solidarity, a collection of essays talking about class issues and working class power and all that important stuff. Those were back in the days when we used to go to bookshops and hear people talk, which I remember seeing you at the wonderful Housemans in London. Now you've just published Tracksuits, Traumas and Class Traitors, book of a collection of essays and stuff. Could you tell us a little bit about that book, what kind of your writing method and what propelled you to continue writing this stuff?
Yeah, sure. I guess halfway through the book tour for Chav Solidarity, I realised how much I'd left behind, how much I'd left out, how much I hadn't covered. I do the read-ins and have chats with folk after them. And people ask good questions and interesting shit comes up. And it was just like, there's a wealth of shit to explore that I hadn't done. So, you know, and even before Chav, I wrote little bits and pieces here and there. And I try, whether I'm writing a book or not, I'm trying to write something every day because it's a good process. Doing the tour, I just started to write down some of the ideas, but also some of the people who were in the first book, some of the people from my life who I didn't think I spent enough time with, or I didn't capture them in there, their full complexity, which is probably fucking impossible, but I didn't feel like I did them justice. So I wanted to go back and address some of that, particularly the people. So the first two, the people who maybe came across as the easiest to demonize in the books. So specifically my dad and my granddad. And I wanted to give them a bit of complexity because I was hearing a lot from people going, oh, those were evil bastards and that kind of thing. And I didn't feel comfortable with that. That's not who they were. That's not how I viewed them. Those were the first two essays I wrote, the two that spend a bit more time with those guys. And from there, it just kind of took on a bit. Yeah, and I just kept going and writing a few other things. And I was also once realizing that whereas Chav was very much me just screaming, there was a lot of anger in it. There was a lot of grief. And it was quite ranty, quite polemic. And I'm still ranty and polemic in the new book, but maybe I wanted to pull myself in a bit more, give it a little bit more, put a bit more rigorous analysis in, and also connect it to the other work that exists out there, the work that's informed me and inspired me the last 15, 16 years of my life as the things that have challenged me, the things that have pushed me towards certain forms of social movements and social forms of working class organizing. So I wanted to bring them into it and have them meet these people from my life, and also have them meet me as a 14-year-old, as a 15-year-old. Once it got going, it just kind of progressed from there.
I just wondered actually about does the writing as you do it, do you, have you ever kind of written everything down and gone, yeah, that's bang on, that's what I'm after? Or does it go through drafts, or do you go, nah, this shit isn't working at all, I've got to rewrite this? Do you ever get that? Or?
Oh, God, yeah. I live with my partner and a couple of mates, and they'd go out to work, come back, What have you done today, Dom? Well, I wrote 6,000 words and deleted it all.
Yes.
That was not uncommon, let's put it that way.
You haven't deleted an entire book yet?
Oh, God, yeah. Like three or four times over. And sometimes it'd be a case of like coming back to the idea or the story or the narrative. And sometimes it was just going, nah, I can't touch that and do it justice yet. And maybe it's something for later down the line. So one thing that got written was like a 10,000 word essay on like an analysis of from 2011 to 2015 and the community organizing I'd been involved in, like in the in the years after the sort of the, I don't know what people want to call it, London riots, the insurrection, the insurgency after Mark Duggan got assassinated. So I did a lot of the organising then, so I wrote an analysis of it. And it was in the book until last minute, then I just deleted it all out. And I go, I'll write that again another day. There's a lot of deleting. I can't think if there's anything that is in the new book that is close to being a first draft. I think they've all gone through rewrites at least a couple of times.
Well, that's good. I can totally relate to that. So glad to hear I'm not the only one. If you really read something back and you're like, who the fuck wrote this? Oh, it was me.
Yeah.
What was I on that day? You are actually in quite good depth in your... before I go on to the book, because there's something that struck me, and I'm sorry, I can't remember which essay it's in the new book, but it's... you talk about reading where you were reading certain writers back in the day, James Baldwin or people like that, who were really, oh God, this is amazing. Whereas now a lot of your reading is kind of like you go into it to go, I'm looking for this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not as much fun, perhaps. At least.
I get it occasionally, like the same level of like, it gets the blood pumping to the head, like there's a smile on your face, but it's definitely rarer than it used to be, that's for sure. Yeah. I guess it's a... getting older, you get more cynical, or I don't know, you have to look harder to find the stuff that gets your blood pumping. I think it's mainly it.
I've got to say, and this is genuine, we'll come on to this in a minute, but a lot of the stuff I've read through Lumpen has actually done that for me.
Oh, that's great.
It's the first time in a while I've just gone, oh, fuck yeah, you know, this is, and I really enjoyed Dorothy Spencer's poetry. But as I say, we'll come to that. We'll talk about Traxxas Drama's Class Traitors first. We'll come to that in a while. But a great deal of detail you write in the introduction, which I was very interested in, about the writing process. I'd just like to ask you a little bit about queer logic, which was one of the things that you put in the intro as being the what kind of guided you the way you were writing. What do you, in a kind of a practical sense, what does that mean, and how does it guide your writing?
It's queer methodologies I refer to.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. Yeah, no worries. For me, it's very hard to like pinpoint. I think the people who write about queer methodologies would say that there is no singular queer methodology, and that's both its strength and its weakness. But for what it brought for me is the need to unpack some of the cultural norms, some of the binary ways of looking at things that I for sure have been like trained in and embedded in how I go through my everyday existence. Like there's the thing. Queer logic, you've got me calling it now.
Yes, sorry.
queer methodologies, approaching life, or approaching, in this case, a piece of writing and subjects in it, without reducing it to the useless binaries of good and bad, of worthwhile and not worthwhile, what's been as and gender as well, a way of unpacking that a little bit, of understanding that, you know, as you know, I'm a white cis male working class lad from the Midlands, and like I've been told to behave as masculinely as I can, to behave in a particularly like to perform whiteness in a certain way, in like in for me anyway, in an aggressive, assertive, dominating way. And like these are things that queer methodologies help me like challenge within myself and shift in myself and try and like, I guess it's a call to empathy if nothing else, and I think it's many other things. But it was something that was, I guess James Baldwin is probably like an epic example of that, of like approaching things that you are told by society to accept as the norm and twist them and like recognize them as things you can play with and things you can think about in different ways and look at from different angles. Like the social experience we have living in contemporary Britain is not natural. It is like something that is socially constructed, something that is, you know, it is the way it is because of particular forms of political and economic power and those with it wanting it to be this way. That it doesn't mean it has to be this way. To engage with our imaginations of what could be, what else out there is there, what could we move towards, queer methodologies does a lot of that work, or helps us do a lot of that, as does the abolitionist stuff that's also in the text.
You talk about if I've got this right, if I've written this down right, an abolitionist lens that you see a lot of stuff through, and the carceral logic of capitalist society. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And there's a lot of good stuff in this book about abolitionism, which as I say, in my experience, I've not read in too many other places. I don't know if some of the references you make, I need to catch up with those writers, but this is certainly one of the first places I've really been strongly introduced to more of an abolitionist viewpoint.
Yeah, I guess the way I view things, life is, and especially where I'm living now, I guess where we're both living now, is that we come from a legacy of colonialism. We come from a legacy of capitalist infrastructure being built and certain bodies and certain people being, you know, violently oppressed and demonized and shat upon and all those kind of things. And different technologies, different state apparatus have been put in place to ensure that. So I guess the popular one at the moment, the thing that's kind of in the press, is the police. So like, you know, the origins of the police are fairly well known as, you know, private contractors to protect property who became a state tool. They were always that's what they were always there for. They were there to enforce private property laws. And, you know, now we have what we have, where they are still enforcing private property laws and still murdering people on the streets. And that's both in the US and it's over here. And I guess there's a lot of focus on prisons. I guess quite a lot of people view prison abolition as a thing. And, you know, the first prisons over in the Caribbean, it's where they put slaves who wouldn't behave themselves and later freed slaves. And then we had the first prison over here shortly after that, and one in London, I can't remember its name. And so that's what these things are there for. They are there to maintain capitalism, maintain power for those who want it. So an abolitionist lens, in one sense, is about the abolition of these mechanisms, these tools. But it goes beyond that, like, because, you know, the police and prisons have their work isn't just the work that the state needs them to do isn't purely a punitive force. It's not just power being forced upon people. They need coercion. So we have institutions which are coercive. We have cultures which are coercive. You know, I guess Gramsci's hegemony, the concept of that, of like the manipulation of media, the idea that we are going to shape what the culture, what the way people, the culture, the society has, the ways people interact. But for me, the abolitionist lens is to deconstruct that and to replace it with something that benefits us all far greater. So I've been having these conversations lately about social workers. And, you know, quite often social workers, some of them are viewed as like people who want to do good, want to like help out, like make people's lives better, like, you know, they care, all that stuff. And I say this as someone who has got friends who are social workers, but that's never been social work's job. Like, the job of a social worker is to manage, manipulate, and record the actions of working class people. there's a long history throughout the 19th or 20th century of like fairly horrible abuse that the social services and social workers performed on working class and in the same way many of these tools do, focused on black and brown bodies. But the whole of the working class got the shit end of the straw. And like my experience of social workers, you know, growing up, like, they were an ominous threat. Like, would I be taken into care? Would my mum be sectioned? You know, would my sisters be punished for some this, that, and the other? Like, they weren't there to facilitate our family's improvement or our context to be any better. So, yeah, an abolitionist lens engages with these institutions, but as well as that, for me, it's also like engages with how I want to carry myself and how I want the networks and friendship circles I'm in to engage with one another. So I don't want to be like, I guess the dominant way of being is if someone slights you, they get punished. If it's a friendship circle, you know, maybe you'll shun them, maybe you won't speak to them for a bit in a partnership, and like me and my partner, like, you know, if they piss me off, maybe, you know, dominant logic, castle logic tells me to like punish them for that. Say, oh no, I'm not talking to you today, you've annoyed me. But that doesn't take into account, like, that is an example, or the examples I use in my book of like the things I did and the things that were done to me. Like, they are done because those the individuals concerned, different things are going up for them. Like, there's a wider social context that they are placed in. So for me, going about the world, I don't want to be fucking, you know, punishing people or like being acting punitively towards people who slight me. I want to be like going, okay, we're all this. If someone's, I'm trying to think of a good example. If I hear someone's been talking about me behind my back, like a close friend, maybe they've betrayed a confidence. Instinct is to get pissy with them. But really, what I should be doing is like, okay, why did this happen? Like, what pressures were going on in their life? Have I been part of that? Like, is there a process, like a conversation we can have about why that might have happened? That's very difficult within, you know, the society, the culture we live in. That's everyone, you know, is very, you know, we're very defensive. We like assume people are out to get us a lot of the time. For me, like, this abolitionist lens is about both this cultural thing, the thing we have in our communities, but it's also like against these social institutions which have caused and still cause a great amount of harm. I guess the abolitionist lens is about harm. Let's not think of like a harm as one individual perpetrates on another, especially when we're not engaging with all that, these huge social harms that, occurring to all of us each day. So, you know, the state policies cause harm every single day, but, you know, in general, we're more pissed off when someone, nicks a bottle of vodka from the off license. Yeah. That dude gets sanctioned more than the state harm that's caused. So it's like we're not viewing these things proportionally. Yeah. We need to be thinking. For me, we need to be thinking a lot more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I recognise a lot of what you're talking about there. I wonder if people, especially in the world we live in today, feel that any kind of institutional damage or crime is just something that's kind of beyond their ability to do anything about, so they don't bother. But it's always the get pissed off with people, you know, around the corner, because, like you say, nicked a bottle, or in the work environment like I work in, with some people saying, well, you know, this person over here's done less work than I have on this. Yeah. You know, and I'm just like, this is not, I know I'm your union rep, but you've got to kind of understand this is exactly what I'm here for. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not here for you to have a petty argument with that person over there. But yeah, and absolutely, I recognise that notion of, you know, if someone, like, I get really upset if anyone's dishonest with me. I feel really aggrieved. I admit to that. If someone lies to me in some, but yeah, sorry, go back to what you were saying, your example from the book.
Well, just first I'll just touch on that. It's like, we've got to a state where a lot of us, and even those of us who are engaging with these ideas, we're still in the same boat, where we often go into the world and into our interactions assuming everyone has just, like, it's a blank slate, like everyone's at an equal start, everyone's, you know. And that's not how things are. Like, there are certain there's many social systems which are putting all manner of different pressures and holding people back in different ways. So making their everyday decisions that much more complicated, you know. So my period of when I was homeless, you know, for a decade or so, like, you know, I'd get, you know, shit on the streets with people, you know, physically attacked and, you know, spat on, abused, all that stuff. And I understand the logic, because they're going, well, that person's just made this choice. This person's been lazy, or look, I'm not homeless. Why is that person, you know, that's on them, without taking into account the things that came before that to put that person in that situation. And for me, this applies to, like, so these two particular essays in the book, like, so the one I talk about, the sexual abuse that my grandfather and his friends, like, carried out on me for a couple of years. Pretty serious sexual abuse. Well, all sexual abuse is pretty serious, but, you know, it's something that has had a long-term impact on me, like 32 years, 31 years later, still does. And when I was talking about Chaff Solidarity, when I was going around doing talks about it, like I said earlier, there was a lot of people who were like, that man's fucking evil. That man should be punished. And that's not how I think of it. Like, so my granddad was an Irish traveller. And he moved to England about 7 years before I was born. And I go into the details of his life extensively in the book. But, you know, he grew up in a deep, profoundly violent household. Suffered various forms of harm within that household. He was also, like, a persecuted minority as a traveller in Ireland, and, you know, various forms of state violence went upon him, and from a very early age. So the story was in that my family was that he killed his dad, when he was 15. My great-granddad, and because my great-granddad was so violent, like, the assaults were just so relentless. So my granddad, at that point, when he supposedly killed his dad, he took over the, like, responsibility for the house, so, which was a big household, big kinship network. It was, yeah, many brothers and sisters, cousins, aunties, uncles. And he took responsibility from the age of 15 until his death, so for several decades. And he carried that despite facing all kinds of persecution, all kinds of, like, violence upon his person, both systematic and interpersonal. Now, that does not excuse what he did to me and what he did to other members of my family. But, like, at no point was he given an out to deal with any of the trauma that was meted onto him. Like, that was not within the social structures. That was not within the cultural system he existed within. He had to just carry that, and it undoubtedly, like, chewed the shit out of him. Like, I say in the book, like, I've got, I've struggled with complex post-traumatic stress disorder for most of my adult life, partly because of the stuff that happened with my granddad and partly for other stuff. I have no doubt he did as well. But I've had outlets, I've had therapy, I've had counselling, I've had, like, profound emotional support from friends. He had none of that. He just had to carry on and carry on. And it knocks you up. Like, you end up, you do things, like, if you're having a particularly bad patch with this, that you might not do otherwise. In another essay, I talk about an assault I carried out when I was a teenager. And there were various, like, contextual, there were various things around me at the time which put pressure on me to do this. I touch upon some of them in the book. So there were social pressures and social stresses, and plus this trauma I'm talking about, I was carrying that with me as well. And I was caught for that, and I was punished. But there was very little engagement with what had got me there. There was no responsibility taken by anyone else. Like, at best, it was like, it's the kid's fault. And bear in mind, I was 15, illiterate, had drug and alcohol problems, and come from a profoundly abusive family. But it was either on me, or it was on my mum, and maybe my dad, who wasn't really around. Like, that's who the state would have blamed. Negating the state entirely from its responsibility for putting us in the poverty that we were in. You know, one of the tenets or one of the parts of abolitionist practice is transformative justice. It's looking for ways where we can find justice which do not just reinforce power dynamics that have existed beforehand, which is what the state does, which is what the criminal justice system does. That just reinforces state power, reinforces patriarchy, reinforces the white supremacy system, reinforces the class system. Transformative justice looks to transform the context we're in. It's a collective responsibility, a collective engagement with moving past the individual harm and making the situation an improved one. Now, that's not rule out entirely. It doesn't rule out entirely things like shunning, things like, things which could be perceived as punitive. But that all depends on the levels of accountability that individuals were able to take. So, were my grandfather, were we able to go back in time to the late 80s and I talk about this in the book, had the community around me, both the family network and the kinship network, but also, others who lived with us or lived near us, had been able to get together and go, this is happening. This is happening to this boy. This man is doing it. This man and his friends are doing it. And address those men, that man and their friends, and said, you need to stop this. We need to find a way for you to stop this, because we're going to take this kid out of your reach. But we don't just want to set you on fire or throw you in prison forever. We don't think that's going to help anyone. We're going to ensure that no one else gets harmed by you. But we need you to take some level of accountability for what you've done. But also, we need to recognise all the things that have been done to you, and we need to move forward together. Now, it's obviously going to be hugely complicated. Again, in the book, I say that network of people, that kinship network, that community, were deeply traumatised because of legacies of colonialism, living in a class system. Like, this was not a bunch of well-meaning anarchists who have a consensus meeting. This was damaged fuckers. I include myself in that. So, that's a difficult process. We have to unpack all that trauma. So, yeah, I guess those are two essays in the book where I try and engage with this kind of abolitionist process, this transformative justice. Yeah.
No, I agree. There's a lot of really important points there. I mean, you go into great detail, as I say, more than I've seen in most work of this idea. And I just a couple of questions to sort of challenge that. I do understand the logic that people see in a punishment idea, in a punishment narrative. Never mind how much it doesn't really seem to ever work, doesn't prevent future crimes from happening, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to, so when you talk about any kind of abolition, you get the, and a lot of arguments aren't worth engaging with because people are, they're just arguing for the sake of it. The idea of, what do we do with the murderers and the rapists? That's the one that always comes up. What do we do? What's the community answer? And I also think people have an attitude, I'll admit, I think this is an attitude that mostly comes from fictional ideas of the brutality of community justice. But maybe there's some kernel of truth within it somewhere. The idea that if a community deals with its own justice, is that not a bit, is there not the possibility for someone's rights to be violated in some way? And with all of that in mind, your argument is I think very deep and complex and very important. And we live in times that I think don't do very well with complexity. Everyone wants everything to be simple. How do we communicate this And the ultimate goal, I hope, which is how do we change things?
I mean, I think you're right that we are in a moment in society where complexity is frowned upon and simplicity is welcomed with open arms. And I guess partly that's because of the sheer depth of complexity that we're living in. Like, it is fucking confusing. We want a simple way out. Yeah, I think for me, like, this isn't really a case of waving a banner, if that's ever an answer to anything, or, speechifying about it extensively. Although, you know, having conversations is important. I think it's the same as any community organising. It starts with what you're doing on the ground, what you're doing with your neighbours, what you're doing with your people in your communities, the way you're interacting with. When I say community, I mean, like, doesn't have to be geographical. Some people are in different structured communities, online or wherever else. And like, it's through practice. Like, I understand some of this. I understand a bit of this. And there are people who've been researching and doing this for decades. Like, this is not a new, it's not a new idea. It's like, I thought about it, but there's other people who have thought about it much harder. Like, what do we do as a rapist? What do we do as a murderer? How do we ensure that community justice doesn't become just vengeance? Like, people have thought about this and they've put it into practice. And for me, it's like looking at those examples, and I try and bring some of them up in the book. A lot of them are stateside in the US, but a lot of the ones in the US come from like a deep black tradition, within the African diaspora. Like, some of them connect to work that's been gone on in Australia and by Aborigines, the indigenous people of Australia, and in indigenous people in Southern America. Like, it's essentially, criminal justice system and the carceral logic is a white European thing, which is we've just like shat over the world with. So there's a deep tradition of this. There's a lot of thought being put into it, and there's a lot of practice being put in. So I feel like it's learning from some of that and finding ways which are appropriate to bring into life in our communities. In social justice movements, I've been involved in a few, like, accountability processes around sexual assault. So someone has accused someone else of sexual assault, and it's been a case of addressing that without bringing in the police, the state. It's like engaging with both the perpetrator and the survivor, and finding out what they both need and what they both want, how they want to move forward. And sometimes that goes really badly. Sometimes it's like lots and lots of meetings, and then everyone loses energy and nothing really happens and people are sad. And sometimes, Often the difficulty is like the perpetrator accepting responsibility for what they've done, but once that's happened, then others can take responsibility for creating cultures. So I had a conversation. Well, I was part of a process. I don't know when it was, 3-4 years ago, and like it wasn't even a friend of mine who was the perpetrator. It was like I knew them vaguely, but they were part of a very similar circle to mine, and there had to be. And the assault had happened in a drinking culture, and I cannot pretend I was not part of that drinking culture. And it wasn't just me, but I had friends who were like also part of that, and we had to like take some responsibility for allowing certain drunken behaviours to be acceptable, and not challenge like certain languages or certain demeanours. We had to become accountable both to the person who it happened, the perpetrator and the survivor. Like, okay, we created culture which made it possible for this person to think they could do that. And I think that's a microcosm of like, wider issues around sexual assault. Like, I think the statistics support me in saying that, the main perpetrator of sexual assaults are men, and we have a responsibility to create forms of masculinity which do not say sexual assault is okay. And like, anyone can say that's not okay, but it's a subtle thing that actually support it, that support like the idea that a man can objectify a woman in that way, like objectify them at all. Never mind, if I make it clear that I think objectifying women's fine, then someone else might be like, okay, what's the next step I can take? What's the next step? Or maybe this is okay. Maybe this is okay. I don't know. We all play a part in creating these cultures. never mind the fact we've got this dominant culture, which reinforces us, tells us all these things about like the relationship between men and women and why, you know, women's bodies are merely there to be objectified by men. But yeah, so like accountability processes are like one thing. Also supporting each other and training each other, skilling up around things like active listening and being able to sit with people who are traumatized and have them express themselves. That's, I mean, that's a profoundly difficult thing to do. Like I was a mental health worker for a few years, and you know, listening to someone who is in like deep psychological agony talk through their shit is hard work. But for me, my view on the world is like a huge number of people, like huge numbers of my community and other working class communities are in deep psychological pain. And we don't all have the access to be able to work through this shit. So we need to do that for one another. And it happens up and down the country. People are doing this. Like you go into, most of the money in my pocket, if you go into any working class community anywhere in the country, there is someone doing this work, someone who is listening, someone who is facilitating the survival of others in different, on an emotional level as well as a material level quite often. So it's engaging with those people who are doing that work, supporting them to do it. Quite a lot of the time, people won't refer to it as abolitionist work, or they won't refer to it as transformative justice work, but it will be that. It's about like seeking to shift the conditions and shift the emotional landscape and psychological landscape of your people. That for me, that's a fundamental starting point.
Kind of within the same realm then, while we're still on stuff that you talk about, and particularly in the new book, you write quite a lot about mental health support, the lack of it, the state's failure in regards to this. How do you think the system is now, and would you compare it across the time periods that you have been a part of it? Has anything improved, or is it still overall part of the term you used that I found very interesting, which is medical industrial complex?
Okay, so I'll preface this by saying pharmaceutical drugs, like some people need them and they are beneficial to some people's lives. And I would not say that anyone shouldn't be doing them if that's what they think is best for them. Completely done with that. But the medicalized model of approaching mental health, which essentially treats it as an individual focus, as each individual has their own individual problems, which we must individually take care of, is deeply fucked. Like, it's doing something that neoliberalism really wants us to do. It's placing all the emphasis on individuals' responsibility for getting better, to fixing themselves, for that it's their problem. And it just isn't. The numbers of people coming forward with mental health issues, which I guess is one thing that has changed in more recent years, is the willingness to talk about it, tells us that there is something socially wrong. Like, you know, whether it is when was it? I think 4 years ago, there was like a big outcry about the amount of mental health referrals within schools. Like, of course kids are having like needing mental health referrals. The amount of fucking stress and strain and pressure coming at them from every fucking angle, it's intolerable. And that's just for like, you know, a kid who has a very healthy home and like is, you know, happy most of the time, but goes into a school environment, goes within the context of a world that's on fire. Of course they're going to have mental health issues, but those issues would be much slighter if the school system was very different, and if the world was very different. So these aren't, it's not that individual's problem. So sometimes the levels of social and cultural, political and economic strain that goes down on someone can cause like incredibly individualized process to occur. So like I say, my diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, that's caused because of the context in which I grew up in and which I was raised in, and the things that happened to me, and the fact that it took over a decade for me to be giving any support from anywhere, from the state or from friends and community to be able to process any of that. My mum had was diagnosed as bipolar. She was diagnosed as schizophrenia. When she engaged with the mental health system, it was again a punitive one. It was them seeking to punish her. Whenever she was sectioned, she'd come back out worse. She'd come back out tired. She self-medicated on heroin and booze, and that was better for her than going into those psychiatric units, because she felt agency. She felt control over the situation, which is far more. It's far a bit more beneficial to your health than having your autonomy and your agency stripped from you, which is what the medical industrial complex does. And also, moving on from the medical industrial complex, we have to see this. We have to have a recognition of all the things that it is tied up in. It's not just a psychiatric unit. It's a prison. It overlaps with the prison system. It overlaps with the education system. It overlaps with the housing system. I mean, I'm sure people, I mean, I definitely have, and I'm sure others listening, who have lived in shitty cramped accommodation, which is no good for your mental health. I live in, the way I live now is I have skies, I have space, I have clear, there's no mold in the air most of the time. These things are beneficial to you. If you're growing up at, in a damp, small, mouldy house where the running water's off and on, electricity's off and on, that's bad for your mental health. If you're growing up in an estate where everyone's in the same fucking boat, that's bad for your mental health. And these housing situations, they're state generated. They're socially constructed. This is not how we have to live. There is enough space. There is enough space for housing, which is. Has a far greater quality and a far more beneficial to our mental health. There's a wider social context to all our mental health struggles, and that's where the support should be focused on improving these situations rather than going, let's fix that individual and each of their individual symptoms. And then giving them a diagnosis.
I agree with all of that. I very much even I got a lot of that from your writing, but also from the writing of Mark Fisher, who also talked about not personalising the kind of mental health. Is it kind of similar to ways you talked about there? It's excellent examples like housing, where you're living in really substandard ways and places, and to act like that wouldn't affect someone's mental health is a little ludicrous, actually, and quite so.
Yeah, I mean, I think I say in the book, my mum didn't have the language skills to be able to articulate what was going on in her head, and I no doubt there was some pretty fucking dark shit that was going on in her head. But not only was she not didn't have the language skills, she didn't have the community and the support wasn't in place to facilitate her doing so. To giving her the time and material solidity to be able to develop the language. And it's the same for me when I was 15, 16, 17, 18, and in and out of young offenders institutions and care and prison and all that. It's there would be time to time when people would go what's going on for you? I didn't fucking know how to say what was going on for me. That takes time, and that's a long ongoing process. And even in the best support environment, like I mentioned, I was mental health support work. People would get 12-month stays, and within 12 months, so you come out of hospital, they moved into supported living, they get a key worker, which would be me or one of my colleagues, and you'd have to get on with your life, recover, and knowing full well from 6-7 months onwards, you'd have to find somewhere else to live. And maybe you weren't ready for that. Maybe you were in the same boat. Maybe they were in the same boat as I was at 15, 16, 17, 18, or my mum was, where you haven't even got the language out. So building a relationship of trust in which you can carefully learn to speak about, or learn the words, or learn that way to articulate what is going on for you, takes fucking time. And the folks who are coming to us, they've been in and out of institutions over and over again. So they're not going to be that trusting, Just to get to a point of trust that takes a fucking year in some cases. Whilst I'm all for the complete dismantling of the state institutions, if we're gonna have them for a while, and if we're gonna have them for a while, the support we need to offer needs to be a lot more long-termist than it's a short-termist. We're not churning these people out. If we're fully engaged in their recovery, we need to be like a lot more holistic, a lot more like engaged with like thinking 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, building profound, not just relationships as one person, but building relationships, communities. That takes work. I know one of your questions later is how do we respond to the severe economic decline and think of ways for working class to go, people to go forward. But it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you can go straight into that now if you want. That's the next question, so go for it. Yeah.
I say, speaking as someone from poor working class background, you know, we've become deeply atomized. We've been deliberately stratified, and it has been a conscious effort to separate us not just from, you know, not just different groups of people who are on different levels of the economic food chain, but like from our fucking neighbors, from our family, from our partners. Like, we were supposed to think of ourselves as like these singular individual people who are like entirely responsible to themselves and no one else. And because we're so strong, because working class people are like amazing in so many different ways, we've resisted that. So we've maintained some levels of relationships. We've maintained connect levels of community. And we, a lot of us, you know, not all the time and not every day, but a lot of us like keep this going and keep building trust and keep building ways of supporting one another. We need to put the coal in the fire on that one. Like, we really need to push it. We need to push ourselves harder than we have before to trust, to all the things that we've been told about the world of like, these people are out to get us. These people are out to get us. These people are going to take what's ours, going to take up the little bit of cake that we've been offered in these like racialized anti-migrant discourses. It's fairly commonplace. We want a bigger piece of the cake. That's what we need. We need all the fucking cake, frankly.
Yeah, we made the fucking cake.
We made the cake, yeah. And so we have to de-atomize ourselves. Like, and it not just purely based on cultural, like religious cultural backgrounds or the racialized positions we're in or the gendered positions we're in or the family kinship. We need to go beyond that. We need to like comprehend we are literally a class of people who have been like systematically oppressed and who have given our bodies, our toil to the people in power.
So back to culture, Lumpen, the series how would you describe, are they books, are they zines? They're lovely, I'll tell you that much. They're brilliant on my bookshelf.
We call them journals. I think originally that was a bit tongue-in-cheek, taking the piss out of academic journals, the things that we're not allowed to write for. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, if people want to refer to them as magazines, that's fine. I don't really mind. It is what it is. It's a quarterly thing. We put out every 3 months, collection of different poor and working class writing. Yeah, it's a space, like, because then the dominant, let's call it, the publishing industry, but also the culture industry in general, like, they will create little bubbles for poor and working class stories to come into. And quite often they have to fit a certain narrative, or if they are outside of that, if they are like of resistance, the industry has to know they'll sell. And that, you know, that doesn't mean there's not good stuff in that little bubble, in that pocket. There's fucking great stuff. But it is a small one, and it's deliberately small. If you're a poor working class writer and you want to tell a narrative or write something that's voyeuristic or exploitative of the communities you come from, you're allowed to do that outside that bubble, especially if, you know, you can sell it. If the publishing company is willing to. The publishing industry is elitist, profoundly middle class values, profoundly, the people, the editors, the people who decide what goes out there come from a certain culture, a certain way of being, and they want it to stay like that. You know, it gives them power, it gives them wealth, gives them a level of economic stability. Doesn't challenge them, doesn't ask anything of them. When we started this, and I, I need to make sure we give the other three people in the co-op, Hannah, Dorothy and Shannon. So when we started this, whenever it was, 18 months ago, the idea was just to do the one issue or like as a book. And it was, but it was clear, like the number of people wanting to write and saying, oh, I've got something, I don't know how to tell it, can you help us with that? Or just going, here's my fucking treatise on this, that or the other. Here's 60,000 words, do you want to put that in? Like people who had been excluded from telling their story wanted to, and sharing their ideas they wanted to. So we quickly realized that it could be a, like an ongoing thing. And now we have, like, you know, I think we probably have enough writing for at least another 3 years of journals. And they keep coming in every day. Child Solidarity gave us a bit of cultural capital, a little bit of social capital, like to create a space to do that. They helped us bring in a bit of money to cover the printing costs.
Actually, I loved, and I'm sorry, I don't have, if I was in my usual place, I could reach over to the shelf and grab it. I can't remember the name of the writer right now. I think it might have been Sister Midnight, actually. Anyway, who wrote a piece that, like, the kind of the Ten Commandments, or, you know, kind of a bit jokey, and one of them was, one was always punch down, always punch up, never down.
That was Midnight Shelley.
Midnight Shelley, there you go, thank you. And then but always punch, among other things. I read that over and over. In fact, I read that to a couple of people. This is brilliant. Listen to these 10 rules. I totally agree. Yeah. Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah, and it's beautifully presented most of the time too. And I say this with no piss take. I'm deadly serious about this. The print is good as well, because I don't always I struggle with the way certain things are printed, certain magazines especially. And it's really clear font, which I love. You know, it really helps me. It means I can read more comfortably. And it's, even though I'm often reading in this about things that can be quite uncomfortable.
Yeah,
it's a great publication. But is there anywhere else right now where you think good working class writing or even other culture is coming from? Where's other than that journal?
I mean, like, there's bits and pieces that come out everywhere. As grotesque as the things are, like social media platforms, finding the right things that are going on there, finding different individuals and different collectives that are putting out stuff, has been invaluable to me. But quite often that's just like they just pop across. I've enjoyed the Working Class History podcasts. They've been good. Well,
do you listen to Revolutionary Left Radio from America?
I've listened to bits and pieces, but there's only so much time I can spend listening to American Marxists. So,
there's some good stuff on there. So we are in a time when we're seeing some good organising. We often on this show, Dave and myself often feature a lot of smaller unions that we like to consider ourselves good friends towards, the IWGB and United Voices of the World, among others. We've spoken to people organising, trying to organise within Deliveroo. We're always good to speak to more people in that. And we even covered, you know, the West Virginia teachers' strike a little bit, which for a while. What do you think is the best and most effective organising that's happening right now within working class communities? And, you know?
So I'm in Manchester now. And there's a few organisations doing some interesting stuff. There's an organisation called the Kids of Colour, who do a lot of work around social marginality of young black and brown kids, repping for them in schools, or encouraging them to explore their own ideas and find different ways to articulate. And they've got a really good blog series, which has got, like, you know, kids who are 15, 16, 17, 18 writing about their experiences during COVID. That's been really good. They've got a sister or sibling organisation called Northern Police Monitoring. And they're doing some interesting stuff. Like, you know, it's got a decent balance between, like, theory, like the, you know, an academic lens on things, but also like a practical hands-on approach within communities. There's been a lot of good stuff from No More Exclusions, which is like engaging with like the school to prison pipeline, the ways in, you know, our schools are becoming like these these castle endeavors of punishment for kids, for where they're viewed purely as bodies to prepare for either prison or like menial tasks in life. So yeah, No More Exclusions is pretty, and that's not just in Manchester, I think that's a national thing. UVW, I think you've already mentioned them, I enjoy a lot of that. I've got to give, like, there's a group in London called Shoal who do a lot of, who like doing a lot of this on the ground transformative justice work. I enjoy it. Like, what I've heard from there is pretty impressive. I'm not a complete convert to Acorn. I've got a critique, I won't go into it, but I'm glad they exist. I think they're doing something that's important and valuable. And as far as like, you know, even though it's still quite small, it's still, you know, growing bigger and faster than other organisations on a national level. And, you know, the tactics and strategies of taking direct action over people's living situations is so fucking vital in this time. And I guess organisations like them in the London Renters Union down in London, and Living Rent up in Edinburgh and Glasgow doing similar work in slightly different processes. Yeah, if there isn't that, there has to be housing unions or networks where we engage with solidarity around our housing issues. There needs to be one in every city. There was a project I came across in Brighton when I was down there on the book tour, called the Kodak Squatters Collective, which was like, it wasn't your usual motley crew of the anarcho squatting scene. It was folks who had been houseless for some time, for years on end, and they'd come together with some other folk and started like squatting buildings, and despite, you know, the current legislation around them, and it was very much led by the houseless folk, rather than being an activist led thing. I was quite impressed with that. There's a great group down in Hastings called Surviving the Streets. Couple of brothers are the main folk behind it. I'm gonna kick myself because I can't remember both their names, Surviving the Streets in Hastings, where they'd both guys would have been homeless for decades and got off the streets and now like serve meals, do clothing drives for thousands of people up and down the south coast, where the houseless crisis is just getting absolutely fucking ridiculous.
Well, listen, I greatly appreciate your time. I'll make the official way I sign off. D Hunter, thank you very much for being on All the Rage. Solidarity, and you're welcome back on any time. This has been a really great conversation. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me. I really appreciate it, mate.
No worries, mate. It's been a fucking pleasure. Cheers.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.tracksfm.org.